Do you consider yourself to be creative? Do you think of creativity as a gift, a talent, something that you either have or you don't? Do you find creativity to be a bit mystical or magical, dependent on luck, the muses, or higher powers? Today's guest, best-selling author Jonah Lehrer, has written a book in which he looks at the latest brain science and attempts, in his words, to collapse the layers of description separating the nerve cell from the finished symphony, the cortical circuit from the successful product. In current New York Times number one bestseller, Imagine How Creativity Works, Lehrer makes clear, quote, creativity shouldn't seem like something otherworldly. It shouldn't seem like a process reserved for artists or inventors or other creative types. After all, he points out, the human mind has the creative impulse built into its operating system, hardwired into its most essential programming code. Creativity, it turns out, is a variety of distinct thought processes that we can all learn to use more effectively. And in the book, Lehrer reveals the importance of embracing the rut or thinking like a child, daydreaming productively. He also shows how we can use this knowledge to make our neighborhoods more vibrant, our companies more productive, and even our schools more effective. Jonah Lehrer is a contributing editor at Wired and a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. He writes the head case column for The Wall Street Journal, and his writing has also appeared in Nature, The New York Times Magazine, Scientific American, and Outside. He's the author of two previous books, Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and How We Decide. He graduated from Columbia University and attended Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. Welcome, Jonah Lehrer.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, and I know it's Proust. I'd like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could you briefly talk a little bit about your path to the work that you do? And you can mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Definitely unexpected. I never really thought about being a science writer growing up. In fact, I always wanted to be a scientist. That was the narrative I carried around in my back pocket. And then as an undergrad at Columbia, I had the privilege of working in a really wonderful science lab. It was the lab of Eric Kandel, and we're trying to understand the chemistry of memory. What happens in your brain when you make a memory? You know, what are the proteins and enzymes that allow our memories to endure and persist? It was fascinating research, and I ended up spending about 4.5 years working in the lab. And after about 4.5 years, it became clear to me that I just wasn't very good at scientists. That as much as I loved the ideas of science, I stunk at the manual labor of it. And that was very upsetting to me, that I excelled at experimental failure in a sense. and then after that, I was lucky enough to get a scholarship and to study in England and spent a couple years just goofing off. I figured, if I'm not good at science, maybe I should just try something completely different. So I did 20th century literature, did a year of theology and philosophy. And then after that, I realized that I still miss science. I miss spending time with scientists. I miss asking them questions. I miss the optimism of the scientific enterprise, the sense that we're accumulating facts, we're learning about our universe, the sense that, it's not just cycles of history, that there is actually tangible progress, Our phones keep on getting smaller. There is tangible, measurable progress, and that excited me. And what I loved about neuroscience in particular was the fact that everything connects to it. That if you're interested in art, you can talk about the brain. If you're interested in philosophy, it comes back to the brain. That everything we are comes back to these 3 pounds of meat inside our head. So I really saw neuroscience as both a field of the future, simply because these are where the big mysteries still remain, but also as a way to pursue my interest in other subjects as well, whether it was Proust, whether it was decision-making in economics and philosophy, or whether it was creativity, that it really does all begin inside our head.
Now, what's interesting is that opportunity you found, that choice you made, wouldn't really have been nearly as possible, 20, 30, 40 years ago? In other words, when you say everything goes back to the brain, someone in your same situation a generation ago...
Yeah. It would have been a black box. It just would have been a black box. I mean, that's how psychologists thought of the brain for decades and decades, going back to behaviorism in the early 20th century. The brain was just a black box, and you didn't even really need to peer inside it. You could simply just, see what went in, see which information went in, and then you look at the behavior. And there's a black box in between, and it was irrelevant. But I think we have learned a lot by breaking open the black box, whether it's, fancy fMRI machines or PET scans or EEG or single electrode recording, all these tools we have of actually looking at how the meat works, how those trillion synaptic connections create human nature. Now, this doesn't mean that simply because we can break open the black box, we just stop thinking about psychology or stop thinking about philosophy, that somehow neuroscience has made these other pursuits, these other ways of knowing ourselves obsolete. Absolutely not. I see it as just another level of description.
Right. And one of the things we'll talk about later is in the book you go into not just the brain. You start there.
Yeah.
But you go into cities. You go into schools. Yeah. You go into companies. You go into teams, all of this sort of thing.
Well, that's one thing that interests me about creativity and what drew me to the subject, apart from just the sheer mystery of, you know, the aha moment and where our best ideas come from and how to get more of them. I mean, they're definitely the practical side. But I also saw it as one of these mysteries that you had to approach at multiple levels. You couldn't just talk about creativity from the perspective of the brain cell. That makes no sense, simply because we know which cities we live in plays a big role in shaping our creativity, which cultures we're embedded inside play a big role in shaping levels of innovation. You know, even the color of a room can swing your creative output by, you know, a factor of two in either direction. So we know that context and circumstance and culture plays a huge, huge role. And that's what interests me about the subject. It's not just about the brain. It's also the environment, the situation that the brain is embedded within.
You've written three books. How do you pick the subjects of your books, and how do they build on each other?
It's an interesting question. I don't really think about them as a trifecta, really, or as a triptych. For me, it's just I'm drawn to a mystery. So it begins with this vague sense of curiosity. And for me, with creativity, it really was just the sense of, you know, every once in a while, if we're lucky, we'll have an epiphany in the shower. You know, we'll have one of those aha moments. And there are few things, there are few mental phenomena that strike me as quite as befuddling as one of these moments of insight, one of these aha moments, simply because, you know, all of a sudden the answer appears. And as soon as it appears, we know this is the answer. This is a solution we've been waiting for. It comes attached with this feeling of certainty.
One of the things you talk about is how stumped,
yeah,
frustrated,
exactly.
All that.
We're
going down every trail.
We're ready to give up. And then boom, it comes to us.
And when it comes, you say, there's no like double checking.
No. You don't double check the math. You don't have to think it through. You know this is it. So that struck me as such a weird phenomenon. Like as if the cortex is just sharing one of its secrets that I wanted to know more about it. And so that's really where my interest in creativity began, just from that very, very childish sense of how does this happen? This is so weird. And then the book kind of spiraled out from there.
Well, tell me about the first two books, though, also. Proust was a neuroscientist and How We Decide.
Yeah, so Proust was a neuroscientist, grew out of I was a grad student at Oxford and was studying 20th century literature and thought I was done with science because I was so bad at it. And just couldn't stop thinking about it. So I wrote a thesis on Virginia Woolf and her relationship to the psychology of her day. And then I started thinking about science and art, about how when you read the diaries of someone like Virginia Woolf or George Eliot, you read their letters, or you Proust or Cezanne, these great artists, they're not simply in the entertainment business. They're not just trying to make time pass to paint pretty things. There's a real sense of empiricism in their, you know, in their project. They want to capture the truth. They want to tell us something that will last. And that got me really thinking about, you know, what is the purpose of art, and does art endure in a sense because it tells us something true with a capital T, about human nature, about how we see the world, about how we make sense of it, about how the self works, about the stream of consciousness. You know, artists really do pioneer and shape the way we think about ourselves, and I think sometimes they get it right.
And so that's the Proust thing, is that suddenly you're looking with your neuroscience
eyes at
what he did.
Exactly. And I quickly became insufferable. You know, I was the kind of guy who would walk into an art museum and mutter about the visual cortex while looking at the paintings of Paul Cézanne. And my friends would mock me mercilessly. But that was the fun part. It just felt like once I started thinking about the possibility of the connection, I saw those connections everywhere. Sometimes I hallucinated them too. In fact, some would say that entire book was one big hallucinatory connection. But you know, I honestly believe part of the reason we still read Proust is because he got something true about human memory. He really captured it accurately. And the reason we still go back to the lighthouse is because the way Woolf depicts our stream of consciousness is a depiction that feels accurate.
What you're saying at some point in the book is that the brain science description would be very similar to the Virginia Woolf.
In fact, is very similar. That there's a verisimilitude into the lighthouse, the way she describes the way our thoughts flow, which took neuroscience decades to catch up with. And in terms of Proust and memory, you know, his insights into the malleability of memory, how in a sense we're always recreating our memories when we describe them. That was a theory which no one had really even contemplated until 10 years ago. And yet you read Proust and it is everywhere. It is saturating the novel. So that, you know, it's just a small sampling of I think some of the ideas that now seem so radical, seem like these crazy ideas from science. But when you go back to the art, they're often there in the art 100 and 150 years ago.
I'm curious if you're familiar with Leonard Schlein's book, Art and Physics.
Yeah, no. Absolutely.
And Schlein also starts out as a physician,
yeah.
Basically a scientist, who then starts writing and sees visual art and physics.
Yeah, very, very similar ideas. You know, the theme that connects them is the sense that there are many different ways of knowing our world, that there is no single path to knowledge, and that, you know, we need both ways of knowing. We need the methods of the artist, you know, which tend to rely on introspection, which try to make sense of the world from this very human, you know, human perspective. And we also need the scientist who wants to break things apart, who wants to make sense of reality by dissecting it into photons and electrons and neutrons and neurons and enzymes and proteins and all the rest.
And both
we need
of them,
both ways of knowing.
And both of them, the scientist and the artist, need the creativity.
Absolutely. That is one thing they absolutely share. And what interests me is that every once in a while these two ways of knowing converge, that they settle on similar themes, that coming from very, very different perspectives, they end up converging on the same idea.
And Who Decides, which was, again, quite an influential book, I think.
That really came from this was perhaps the most practical of my books because it really grew out of my own pathological indecision. I was the kind of guy who would spend 20 minutes choosing a toothpaste in the drugstore. If I had to choose a breakfast cereal, I could waste a half an hour in the cereal aisle. And this drove me crazy. It drove my wife insane. Eventually I said, enough's enough. I got to figure out how this decision-making process works. What's going on inside my head when I struggle and fail to pick a box of Cheerios, and how can I get better at this process? So that's very much where that book came from. And, of course, decision-making was, I think, one of the first areas in which neuroscience, using in large part fMRI technology, brain scanning technology, really had made some very interesting discoveries that we can begin to apply to the everyday world.
Now, let me tell people, that's the voice of Joan O'Lehrer, and I'm Terrence McNally, and we're speaking about his book, Imagine, How Creativity Works, and you can learn more about all of his books and a lot of articles and a lot of blogging that he does at several publications at Jonah Lehrer, J-O-N-A-H-L-E-H-R-E-R, jonahlehrer.com. How we decide... It seems to me one of the things that's going on there is, as you say, brain science could track that. What were they finding out? What was the big?
Yeah.
Why do you stand there at the cereal line?
Yeah. The one of the big themes to emerge from this new science of decision making, that happens when we break open the black box, is you go back thousands of years, really ever since Plato, and humans have seen themselves as rational creatures. We are rational agents. What defines us? What makes us special, what's our Promethean gift, is really this ability to consciously deliberate and analyze all the options. And this, of course, becomes the rational agent model in modern economics, incredibly influential. And it's just one thing neuroscience has found is just not true. It's not the way we think, that we are instead profoundly emotional creatures. It's our emotions and passions that drive much of our behavior, drive most of our decisions. And then you can find these patients, and this is largely the work of Antonio Damasio, who thanks to a brain injury have lost the ability to experience their emotions. So they are perfectly rational. They are Spocks among us. And you think, oh my gosh, here are these people, no emotions at all. They should be the best decision makers. They should be philosopher kings, right? Because no emotions getting in their way, no biases, no prejudices, no blind spots. They're just perfectly rational. But instead, what you discover when you look at these patients who can't experience emotion is that they are pathologically indecisive. They are like me in the cereal aisle, only 10 times worse. That they can spend 4 hours trying to figure out which sandwich to order. They can spend an hour debating between a blue pen and a black pen. That they are often incapable of making any decisions at all. And, you know, so this is one of the first pieces of evidence that pure reason, this thing we've been aspiring to for thousands of years, it's not a blessing. It's actually a disease. And that we need our emotions to make any sort of decision. So really neuroscience began with that insight that our emotions are essential. And then has since shown exactly how they work, why sometimes they let us down, why sometimes our emotions lead us to sleep with the wrong people and take out subprime mortgages and spend too much on our credit card and eat too much chocolate cake. So our emotions definitely are not omniscient. They're not perfect. But why they're so essential and how that process unfolds. That's really what the book is about. It's about we do have this, it's called the dual system model. We do have, we clearly are capable of reason, but reason is often much more feeble than we've long assumed.
Yeah, and some of the stuff that we will talk about in here, where in the moment of insight, the shift from one part of the brain to another is basically some of what you're talking about. One thing that you do, which I think is a reason, you know, besides good thinking, that your books interest a lot of people, is you tell stories. And you weave through this book, and you open this book with a story about Bob Dylan. So I'm sure on this tour you've probably told this story many times.
It's one of my favorite stories. I'm a Dylan freak. I've seen that man. I think I'm up to 15 times in concert.
Oh, you're a lucky man too.
I'm a lucky man. And so he's one of my heroes. I've been a huge Dylan fan for as long as I've been listening to music. In many respects, this was a very selfish act. I just want to tell a Bob Dylan story. And so luckily, his life contains multitudes. And so you can find, no matter what you're trying to describe, you can find a Bob Dylan story that'll fit. But in this case, one of my favorite Dylan stories is the story he told in the late 1960s. And there are bits of the story in a number of interviews. Most of it comes from a very famous Playboy interview he gave in 1966. But it's about the year before, May 1965. Dylan's been touring like a maniac for the previous year, totally exhausted. And finally, his manager says, okay, we're just going to send you to the UK, last few weeks of concerts and promotion, and then you can take a break. And so Dylan's in the UK, and he's just so burnt out and strung out. And he also has no idea what to do next.
And luckily for listeners, that's what you see if you rent Don't Look Back.
Yes, exactly.
The Penny Baker documentary is that time in England.
This captures Dylan in this month, where you can see he looks miserable in the UK. He is clearly sick of his music. And for the first time, when you watch some of that footage of the concerts, Dylan looks listless. He looks bored. He looks like he's singing the lines of someone else. And what Dylan says the following year is that he actually quit the music business shortly after coming back from the UK, that he was so strung out, so burned out. He had no idea what to do next. He was sick of folk music. He was sick of standing on the stage by himself, strumming his guitar. But he really didn't know how to reinvent himself. And so he tells his manager he's quitting. He goes up to Woodstock. He doesn't even bring his guitar. He just brings paints and canvases. He's going to become a painter. And then after a couple days relaxing in Woodstock, Dylan, he describes it as getting this familiar feeling, this itch inside his head. And then he just gets out a piece of paper and a pen, and he just starts to scribble. And he scribbles for the next several hours. He describes it as an act of vomiting forth, where these words just come pouring out of him. And he ends up with a 25-page scrawl of lyrics. And within those 25 pages, he has this chorus. And the chorus is, how does it feel, you know, to be on your own, like a complete unknown, like a Rolling Stone, one of the most iconic choruses of all time. And Dylan sees those words and he knows this is it. He knows this is the song he's been waiting for. In these ambiguous lyrics, which are full of venom in many respects, he sees his future. And that's where Like a Rolling Stone comes from. The very next week, he takes those words into the cramped space of Studio A, Columbia Records. And after just four takes, they record Like a Rolling Stone, which is one of the most influential singles in rock and roll history. You know, Bruce Springsteen said it was one of the defining moments of his life, hearing that on the radio for the first time. And that is the song, that bottling of the thin, wild mercury sound, as Bob Dylan put it, which really showed him what he was capable of and showed him what he should be doing. And it was a moment of insight. It came out of the blue. It came only after he quit. It came only after he stopped looking for the song. That's when he wrote his best one.
Yeah. And one of the other things you point out is that almost all of his songs, or maybe even all, prior to that, you could hear a precursor. You could hear Woody Guthrie or a blues song or something
yeah.
in those folk songs.
Yeah.
And this one is...
This one is a total emulsion of his influences. So this one, it clearly has strong influences. There's a bit of La Bamba. There's Woody, I saw some Woody Guthrie in there. There's definitely plenty of blues and Robert Johnson and all the rest. But they are so seamlessly blended together, you know, that, that Robert Johnson sits alongside Bertolt Brecht. And Fellini's right along Woody Guthrie. So you know, one of the things that I think makes like Rolling Stone made it so influential for Bob Dylan in the way he thought about his own work is the way it allowed him to, for the first time, really blend these influences together.
And at that point, when he says, "I can't explain it, I just write them,"
yeah,
we often, I think, have thought, this is one thing that I realized reading your work. We have often thought that was his way of keeping the press at a distance.
Yeah.
But what you say is it's really, he meant that.
Yeah, you know, I honestly think he had no idea where this song came from. That is one very consistent theme that comes when Bob Dylan talks about his writing process, and especially his writing process from these years, from the mid-1960s, when a lot of people think he did his most canonical work. And he describes it as you're being visited by a ghost. You know, just the ghost comes and gives you something, and then it goes away. And that's a pretty perfect description of a moment of insight. It's just you're visited by a ghost, drops off an epiphany, and then disappears. And as Dylan put it, once the ghost arrives, all you want to do is get out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the voice of Jonah Lehrer. We're talking about his best-selling book, Imagine, How Creativity Works, and you can learn more at jonahlehrer.com. Since we've come to, in the Dylan story, this moment of insight that comes after the frustration, after the wanting to give up, after the letting go, and so on, talk a bit, because the moment of insight, is, although it turns out the book expands well beyond yeah. it, early in the book, seems to be the kernel.
Yeah. And like I said, this is really what drew me to the subject, the sheer mystery of moments of insight. And, it, you know, at first glance, it's not quite clear how one could scientifically study such moments, because you can't just put undergrads in a brain scanner and say, have an epiphany. That'd be a very inefficient way to collect data. So scientists really had to come up with ways to generate lots of insights on the fly. And one of the most popular methods is a method used by Mark Beeman at Northwestern and John Kunios at Drexel. And what they do is they give undergrads set of problems called compound remote associate problems. The acronym is a bit unfortunate, CRAP.
Yes.
Well, that's okay to say on the radio.
Yes.
Or at least
certainly
the spell.
Yes. Even George Carlin could spell that on the radio.
And to the problems, they consist of three words, and you have to find the fourth word that forms a compound word. So a sample one is the three words are pine, crab, and sauce. The answer here is apple, pineapple, crab, apple, applesauce. And if apple pops into your head, it almost certainly will arrive in a moment of insight. So it'll just pop into your head out of the blue, and you'll say, aha, that's it, apple. You won't have to double check it. You just know this is it. And so what Beeman and Kunios found is by giving people these kinds of problems inside a brain scanner, in the seconds before an insight appeared, there was a sharp spike in activity in a part of the brain called the anterior superior temporal gyrus, an obscure bit of cortex in the back of your right hemisphere. It's associated with stuff like the processing of jokes and the interpretation of metaphors.
Which makes very good sense, right?
Which makes very good sense because it's also involved the connecting of remote associations. So it involves the bringing together of ideas and words and associations that seem utterly unconnected. It seemed to have nothing in common, and yet this brain air is able to find that thin thread that binds them together. So it begins to make sense why this brain area would seem to be involved in moments of insight. They also found that it's possible to predict up to 8 seconds in advance whether or not someone's going to have a moment of insight.
Now, that's pretty crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very spooky. So they could look at your EEG waves. This they actually found by using EEG.
So I'm taking one of these tests. I'm trying to think of the answer.
And you got electrodes all over your head, and they're measuring the waves of electricity pouring out of your cortex. And they could look at your EEG waves, and they could say, sorry, buddy, you are wasting your time. You should just go home. Or they could say, in about 7.5 seconds, there's a pretty good chance you may have an epiphany. What they're looking for is something called alpha waves. Alpha waves, like most things in the brain, remain pretty mysterious, but they are closely associated with states of relaxation. So, you know, taking a walk on the beach, taking a nap on your couch, watching your favorite TV show, taking a hot shower, playing ping pong, whatever it is that puts you at ease.
For me, these days, I really have noticed that I process, when I'm dealing with a problem, when I'm walking my dog.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, I love hiking in the hills. You know, showers are a pretty good moment for me, too. Lying in bed at 6 in the morning when I don't really want to be awake.
The almost awake, almost asleep.
Yeah, yeah, that kind of liminal space between wakefulness and sleep. Very, very good space. So everyone's got their own their own favorite space where they just forget about work, where they forget about those problems that they can't solve. And the irony, of course, the perverse irony, is that's what I'm most likely to solve them.
And why is that?
Well, it's when we're not relaxed, when we're really focused, when we've juiced on caffeine, our attention's out in the world. We are fixated on pine, crab, and sauce, you know, on the problem itself, and probably a wrong answer associated with that problem.
So, and what you say is we get fixated on the wrong answer. We start looking at wrong answer from every angle.
Exactly. We get stuck on it. So a common wrong answer for pine, crab, and sauce is tree. And so people, for instance, will just be stuck on tree and they can't get past it. And it's not until you're in the shower shampooing your hair that you're able to turn the spotlight of attention inwards. And that's when at long last you hear that quiet voice coming from the anterior superior temporal gyrus or somewhere in the back of your right hemisphere saying, Apple. The answer is Apple. Maybe that voice has been there for hours or days or
weeks. But there was too much stuff going on in front of it.
Yeah, but you just didn't take a moment to listen. So what makes relaxation so valuable is we take a moment to listen. We turn that spotlight of attention inwards.
Okay. And one thing you write about is daydreaming.
Yeah. So
what is daydreaming?
Daydreaming is something we do when we're bored. People are bored a lot.
And by the way, the test for daydreaming was, right?
Tolstoy.
They have them read boring pages.
Boring pages of Tolstoy. Turns out there's no shortage of them.
And within seconds,
No. It's amazing. Look at the eye tracking data. So they actually use eye tracking to see when people start to daydream because they actually read in a different way. And, you know, one sentence in a Tolstoy, people are daydreaming machines. Poor Tolstoy. He's become a punchline for psychologists.
Yeah.
So what they find is that people who daydream more score higher on tests of creativity. And that's because daydreaming is this very rich mental state that it's something we lapse into when we're bored. But it really is about letting the mind wander, turning that spotlight on ourselves. And your brain consumes tons of energy while daydreaming. In fact, some studies suggest
that was one of the big questions, right? They said, what's going on?
Yeah.
We think they're doing nothing
yeah.
in terms of what they're putting out. Why would we evolve to use that much energy doing nothing?
Absolutely. It was a long-standing mystery, especially because I think we've got this prejudice against daydreaming. You know, it's one of the first lessons you learn in school, right? Stop staring at the window. Stop daydreaming. Focus. Look at the blackboard. And yet psychologists had discovered that daydreaming consumes lots of mental energy. And so it was this paradox. Here's this useless mental state in theory, but yet we're always doing it and it consumes tons of energy. So what's going on? And that's when people realize that daydreaming is actually a way to explore counterfactuals, to make new connections. We are mashing up seemingly unrelated ideas. It's actually a very rich source of creative insights. And that's why people who do it more are better at various tests of creativity.
And similar to what we do when we're night dreaming.
Yes. You know, it's not quite as intense, but they share certain themes. Night dreaming is its own very strange process.
We're embedded in stories.
Yes. Yes, there are volumes to be written on night dreaming. So daydreams, we don't have the same sense of narrative. We're not fully dissolved. We still have one foothold in consciousness, which seems to be part of the advantage of daydreaming too in terms of
– And you point out that not everyone who daydreams is more creative, that it depends what you do with the daydream story.
Exactly. So the people who really score off the charts on these tests of creativity – they're not just the constant daydreamers. They're the people who notice when they're daydreaming. So they seem to have one foot in the real world even as they let their mind go down these rabbit holes.
Yeah, very interesting. But what I was going to say about the similarity in night dreaming and daydreaming is this point that for some reason, we've evolved to process connections in a sort of a more passive way. Why? And do other animals do that as well?
Nobody really knows. The assumption is that these are pretty ancient circuits. So people have actually found it's called the default network. That is what we do when we daydream and mind wander. That is a circuitry we rely upon. And people have found the default network in rats, in rodents. So this seems to be a pretty ancient part of the brain. But obviously we can't ask rats what they dreamt last night. They don't sit on the couch for talk therapy.
Right.
They can't decompose their daydreams. So it's tough to know for sure. But the assumption is that at the very least, we share the circuitry that makes these things possible.
And again, evolutionarily, why would that have emerged that we would – I think you say it happens is that we go into a different part of our brain, a different way of thinking, and we make connections to things that are of things that are already there.
I think it's about giving ourselves access to our unconscious. The unconscious we know is this, you know, it's the supercomputer inside our head. It's processing information in parallel. It's sifting through these vast sets of data, looking for interesting connections and associations. And that's what's happening when you're falling asleep, when you enter into REM sleep, which is why, you know, psychologists have done all these studies, and this is a very, very consistent result. You can give people very difficult creative puzzles that seem impossible, and then you can say, okay, here are people who you're not going to be able to nap, so we're going to keep you awake, we're going to give you caffeine, and you're just going to focus on these problems, and you can say, okay, here are the lazy ones, go take a nap, slip into REM sleep, and those who slip into REM sleep solve anywhere from 20 to 40% more of the problems when they wake up. Fabulous. Because when you're asleep, you think you're just offline, but your brain is actually doing some heavy lifting. It's actually still trying to solve the problems, just in a less directed, you know, less directed process. You're more reliant on your unconscious, and it's when you're asleep that you get access to some of those answers.
Yeah, so, it seems to me that, and I felt this as I was reading this, that is, you know, I keep using the word, or we both keep using the word, the mystery, the paradox, and so on. But that to me is an interesting notion that evolution, you know, found.
Yeah.
That the unconscious was valuable and found this.
Well, the larger lesson is just that consciousness itself is just this very recent invention, and it's kind of layered upon this vast unconscious. So consciousness itself is the new evolutionary adaptation. So it's wonderful. It's a wonderful tool. Being conscious is great. You know, it comes with its annoyances every once in a while. Sometimes I wish I could just turn it off. But you know, evolution had invested millions and millions of years in refining this unconscious, which allows us to, you know, do stuff that, you know, you can't make a robot that can catch a ball with the same effortlessness, efficiency of a 4-year-old. That's unconscious at work. We don't have to consciously figure out the, you know, trigonometric path of the ball. We just reach out and catch it.
And the unconscious
does those calculations automatically. And the same thing applies to all sorts of aspects of our lives.
And those things that we do with the unconscious, driving a car, riding a bike, catching a ball, if we try to think about them...
You'll choke.
That's right.
You'll ruin it.
You know David Eagleman's book, Incognito?
Yeah, yeah.
I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, and you know his whole book is exactly that.
No. He's a friend. He's a great, great writer and scientist. And I thought he did a wonderful job in Incognito, really just showing that the unconsciousness in charge, you know.
Yeah.
The old Platonic model of you got the rational charioteer, the conscious chariot, and these two wild horses, the unconscious, you know, our emotions. It's actually a little backwards. That really were, you know, the conscious mind is the rider and he's riding an elephant. Good luck controlling that elephant.
Yeah, I love that image. A couple of just things that were sort of fun and that were seemingly contradictory. I love that. Just so much of that seems to be happening. But if you show someone a clip of Robin Williams doing stand-up for 5 minutes, they'll solve 20% more compound remote, those word association things?
Yeah, and this gets back to the virtues of relaxation. You know, when you're in a positive mood, you're more relaxed. You think in a more diffuse manner. And that's what Robin Williams stand-up puts us in. It puts us in that relaxed, happy mindset. And so as a result, when you give people subsequent word problems, even though it's a 5-minute clip, not long at all, they're going to solve a lot more of those problems.
That's interesting. Also, his mind, I mean, it's interesting that it's Robin Williams because his mind is like that.
Very
association
associative, very quick. And this is Robin Williams in his most manic phase.
Right, in the random
connections. The late 80s where he's just bouncing off walls.
Yeah, yeah. But the other thing you point out is that when people get sad, depressed, melancholy, that has value as well.
Yeah, so far we've really been talking about moments of insight, you know, these sudden epiphanies. And when you talk to creative people, they'll often begin by describing their big epiphanies, those aha moments that came in the shower or while walking the dog. But then they'll talk about all the hard work that came after. How even after you have the epiphany, you still have to edit it. You still got to go through revisions and drafts and iterations. And that's not fun, but it's necessary. You got to make that new idea and you got to make it perfect. And that's where the hard work comes in. And it's in the second phase of creativity, the editing phase, we'll call it, the unconcealing phase. That's where being sad actually seems to help. That people who are sad are better able to focus. They're more vigilant. They're more attentive. They're more persistent. And so you can prime people to feel sad in a lab, in a psychology lab. And this takes about 5 minutes. You show them a short video about death and cancer instead of showing videos of Robin Williams. And what you find is that they're better prose stylists. They're better at copy editing. They're better at refining their sentences. They're better at making collages because they'll stick longer with the collage. So you can have an independent panel of judges who will say, yep, the sad people, their collages are always better. So sadness has virtues too, simply because there are these two very distinct phases of creativity. There's the moment of insight, and then there's the editing that comes after. You want to be happy for the moments of insight, happy and relaxed, you know, where you're not thinking about work. But then for the editing phase, you want to be thinking about work. You want to be attentive. You want to be well caffeinated. You want to be, you know, chained to your desk. You want to be a little sad too.
Yeah. I when I'm not on the radio, I work with organizations on communications and things like this. And a lot of times it has to do with creativity. Yeah. And what I have often said, I'm not sure if I saw this exactly, but I think it sets up, I often have said that creativity, like so many things in nature, like the breath, like the pumping of the heart, like the tides, goes through an expansion and a contraction phase. Yeah. Is that kind
That's
of
That's exactly right. Perfectly said. It's you know, goes through the expansion when we have the epiphany, and then the contraction where we have to edit, because parts of that epiphany aren't going to work in the real world after all. And you know, even Bob Dylan had to refine the lyrics of Like Rolling Stone, and he vomited forth 25 pages, and within that he got 5 awesome stanzas. But that meant there was a lot of words he didn't use.
And you talk about I don't think we've done quite enough with the right and left, and the one that's sorting out, the left sorting out, and the right making the connections.
Yeah, so there definitely is this pop cliche.
And I'm talking about the brain.
Yeah, there definitely is this pop cliche about, you know, the right hemisphere is the artist inside the head, the left hemisphere is analytical, rational. And that's a oversimplification of the way our hemispheres work, but they definitely have different tendencies. What science has learned is that our hemispheres process all the information coming into our head simultaneously, and they're processed in 2 different ways. So your brain basically does double the work. And that's because there's virtue to seeing the world from these different perspectives. So the right hemisphere is more about seeing the whole forest, seeing the connection, seeing the associations.
And go back, if you would, to the moment when, you know, we talked about how they used to think the brain was a black box and pretty useless of studying. Then it turned out they said, okay, the left side's worth studying, but not the right.
You know, that's in large part because when you study people with left hemisphere damage after a stroke or a lesion, their damage is very obvious. They often have severe memory problems, severe language problems. They often can't express themselves. So it's very obvious what's gone wrong with them. When people suffer right hemisphere deficits, it's often much more subtle. They'll often no longer be able to understand jokes or metaphors. They won't have as many moments of insight. But this is stuff that at first glance you don't notice. You know, it's easier to brush aside.
Because they look functional.
Exactly. They can talk perfectly. They can have normal conversations. You know, so what? They can't understand poetry. So it was very easy to ignore. And so for decades, scientists saw the right hemisphere as a mostly useless chunk of tissue. And they didn't quite understand what it did. But it does seem to play a very big role in helping us see the forest, while the left hemisphere is more granular, more detailed. You know, more detail-oriented, more analytical, more interested in each individual tree.
And is there something about people who are able to either hold both open or track back and forth more easily or something?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's about when you look at creative people, obviously without referring to neuroscience for the most part, they have an intuitive understanding that creativity has these swings, that it's got a expansionary phase, as you put it, and a contraction phase. And so they're able to really modulate, I think, their work habits and their moods and how they think about thinking to fit the task at hand. So sometimes they know, okay, I'm stuck. I'm going to go take a long walk. You know, there's this great Einstein line that creativity is the residue of wasted time. So I think, you know, there's a genius who knew that sometimes when you're stuck on a problem, go waste some time. Go take a walk. Go for a sail. He loves sailing. You know, go daydream. And then they also know that sometimes you got to put in the work. Sometimes you got that lead on the idea you're hunting for. You can feel yourself getting closer. And then you want to invest in attention. Then you want to work late nights. You want to stick it through. You want to be persistent and gritty. That's when you'll actually find the answer.
And some people want to take amphetamines.
Yes, I do describe the work habits of W.H. Auden, one of my favorite poets, who what interests me about him is when you look at his career and you look at his most cited poems, the poems which are in all the anthologies, they all come from this 3-4 year window when he first moved to the United States. And then you say, okay, well, maybe it's just because he moved to New York City and he was inspired. Then
Novelty.
But then you look a little closer at his biography and you realize that's also when he started taking benzedrine, which is an amphetamine, which at the time was legal. It was given out to people like candy for asthma.
I mean, you look at Life magazine or Look magazine from that period, and it's not described as a plague. It's described as a wonder.
Yeah, no. It's a productivity tool.
Yeah.
Later, of course, we learn that benzedrine comes with horrible side effects.
Exactly.
It's highly addictive, insomnia, constipation. So Auden spent years trying to quit. So this is definitely not
Not a recommendation.
Not a recommendation. Don't self-medicate with Benzedrine. But for Auden, when he first started taking this drug, it was a he turned him into what he called a poetry machine, where he could spend 12 hours working on a single line, staring at a single metaphor, refining his poetry until it was perfect. And so you look at his poetry from this phase, from his Benzedrine phase, and it's got a precision, a lucidity, a sparseness, which you don't see for the rest of his career. I happen to love his late poetry. I think some of Auden's finest work is his late poetry, which is very intimate, a little more freewheeling, a little more relaxed. But I think there is something about...
But the craft in those...
But the craft in this Benzedrine phase poetry is immaculate, which I think is in part why they are his most famous poems. Looking back on them later, he often resented them. He left a lot of these poems out, his most famous poems out of his collected, out of his collected edition, simply because he thought they were too simple, too clear, not ambiguous enough.
Right. But not poetic enough.
Not poetic enough. But I think there is a simplicity and a spareness to them that appeals to the average reader.
And so we mentioned Benzedrine. Alcohol obviously has, a lot of artists drink out.
Yeah.
What is going on there?
Well, so this is a study I wish I could have put in the book, but it just came out last month. And what they found is it's a large study done at University of Illinois. They got undergrads drunk. Not a little drunk.
Difficult.
A lot drunk. Yeah, exactly. I was like, I bet they had a tough time recruiting for that study. They got undergrads legally drunk, so they couldn't drive. And then they gave them these compound remote associate problems and various very difficult creative puzzles. And what they found is that those who were drunk compared to their sober classmates solved on average about 30% more of the hardest problems. And this gets back to relaxation, alcohol, and makes us more likely to mind wander. The title of a classic Jonathan Schuller paper, he's a guy who does a lot of work on daydreaming and creativity. It's called Lost in the Sauce, where he got people drunk.
Oh.
I guess it's the popular pastime of psychologists getting undergrads a little tipsy. And what he found is that people who are drunk, they daydream more. They think in more abstract associations. Not going to be helpful when you're driving a car. Not going to be helpful when you're taking a chemistry test or doing long division. But when you want to solve a difficult creative problem, being a little bit drunk is actually going to be pretty useful.
Interesting. That's the voice of Jonah Lehrer. We're talking about his book, Imagine How Creativity Works, and you can learn more at jonahlehrer.com. I want to do two things, and I'm not sure if I have time, but tell, if you can briefly, a couple of the stories about organizations using creativity. Maybe Pixar and 3M?
Sure. I was lucky enough to spend some time at Pixar. I've long been a big fan of their work. And what interests me about Pixar in particular is they are basically 12 for 12. Just looking at box office success, they have yet to have a movie that didn't make oodles of money. And, that's a track record, I think, just about every other studio in Hollywood.
And usually with critical –
Usually with critical acclaim. Yeah. So their movies are very popular and beloved by critics. So they've really hit the sweet spot of success in movie making. And so I kind of wanted to understand their secret sauce, what allows them to do that. And you find a couple things. So when you go to Pixar and you first look around, you're like, this is a pleasure dome. They've got drinking holes everywhere, a whiskey bar, a 24-hour gym, delicious food in the cafeteria. It's a beautiful interior with art everywhere. And so you're like, oh, my God, I want a job here. How do I sign up? You spend a little more time than you realize it's a very, very intense environment. That they begin most days with what they call a shredding meeting, which is where they take the footage done from the days before and they tear it apart. They deconstruct it.
And by the way, for people to know, when you're doing animation, the footage from the day before is seconds.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. We're talking 2, 3, 4 seconds. Still several hundred frames, but it's a blip. And they will just dissect it and deconstruct it and
how
tear
many
it apart.
Players? Participate.
It depends, but often you'll have a few dozen in a room.
Yeah.
So the animators and computer scientists, people from these very different fields, coming together to work on a problem.
And what do they mean by shredding?
They mean they're criticizing each other. They're saying they're looking for what doesn't work, and then they want to fix it together. So the assumption being that if you go through that kind of iterative process for 4.5, maybe 5 years, at the end of it, you'll have a pretty good 90-minute cartoon. But it's very harsh. It is not, it's the opposite of a conventional brainstorm.
And let's talk about that. Brainstorming.
Brainstorming is the most widely implemented creativity technique in the world. And the very first rule of brainstorming is don't criticize, right? The assumption being that if there's criticism in the room, the imagination will just shut down. It'll be intimidated. But Pixar does the exact opposite. I think that's the secret of their success. There's this, my favorite quotes in the book comes from Lee Unkrich, who's the director of Toy Story 3. And is on the Pixar Brain Trust. And he describes the Pixar process as too many companies, they assume the way to success is to avoid failure. And he says at Pixar, we do the opposite. We know screw-ups are inevitable. We just want to screw up as quickly as possible. We want to fail fast and then fix it together. And that, I think, is the hallmark of the Pixar process, that it really is about, you know, going over the story, going over each clip, going over each frame in excruciating detail, being very, very critical of it. Sometimes you're going to get your feelings hurt, but that's inevitable.
What I think people – we've all heard – I mean, most of us have heard of brainstorming. And as you say, rule number one is everybody just puts things out and there's no criticism. That will scare the creative process. It'll make you shrink. It'll remind you of being a child and being judged. And that seems intuitively correct.
Yeah.
What is it that's counterintuitively correct that makes Pixar work?
Sure. Well, I think one of the problems with the advocacy of no criticism is that when we actually look at human free associations, they're pretty superficial. So if I ask you to free associate on blue, your first answer will be green, followed by ocean, sky, maybe Joni Mitchell, maybe little Miles Davis, and if you're really creative, you'll say jeans. But not that surprising, not full of breakthroughs. When we're left to our own devices, we tend to skim along the superficial surface of the imagination. And this is why criticism, what psychologists refer to as debate and dissent, seems to be so important for groups. So there are lots of studies out there which show that the much more effective way to work together is to actually engage in criticism, to constructively criticize the ideas of others, to engage in debate and dissent. That
for people who are just listening, is there anything you can quickly say about what makes that helpful rather than hurtful?
Well, because it forces us to dig a little bit deeper. It wakes us up. It invigorates us.
But I meant, is there some way to criticize that makes it better than others? Or
sure. Well, you know, Pixar tries to rely on a method called plussing, which is where instead of just tearing an idea down, you have to say how you're going to make it better. So you have to plus it. That works for them. I don't think – this is where the science stops, I think, unfortunately. I think it's where companies have to really innovate on their own and figure out what works
just
for them.
Just take the given that what you thought was true may not be.
Exactly.
Now figure out how to do the right way.
Exactly. What the science can tell us for sure is that we know brainstorming doesn't work and we know how to make it work better, and that's to engage in debate and dissent.
Okay. 3M. The most amazing thing you said about 3M, which I can't do, you know, I can't go examine it, but you said 3M has 50,000 employees and 50,000 products.
And that's a real testament to the fact that they've been an innovation powerhouse for 60 plus years. They are not a flash in the pan. They've invented Scotch tape and masking tape and Post-it notes. But they also make the glue that holds your smartphone together. They also have helped solve the battery problem for laptops and reduce the electricity usage of LCD televisions by 40%. So they're in drug delivery, you know, every big product category you can think of.
So what are the hallmarks of the way they do it?
You know, I think if there's one theme you can pick out from 3M, it's the importance of what they call horizontal interactions, which is getting people in different domains working on different problems to interact and collaborate. So they do this by holding science fairs where all their scientists come together and present their research. They do this by – they have forced rotations of engineers. So if you've been working on tape for 5 years, they may move you to drug delivery. They may move you to battery problems and laptops. They may move you to something which seems completely unrelated. But what they want you to do is to take all your knowledge, take all your solutions, and apply it to a new domain, a new field, to create those kinds of cross-cutting analogies. So those are some of the techniques they use to really foster those horizontal interactions. They also pioneered an innovation I think many people associate with Google called 15% time, the bootlegging hour, which is they give every scientist 15% of their workday to just do whatever they want, to work on their own hobby problems, pursue their own side projects.
Take a nap if they wish.
Take a nap. And, you know, the real payoff here is what 3M refers to as attentional freedom. What they want to do is send a message to their scientists is, look, we trust you. We think you're smart. That's why we hired you. We're not going to try to micromanage your brain. If you want to take a nap, take a nap. If you want to go for a walk, take a walk. Go waste some time. Or if you want to chug caffeine and sit at your desk, great. That works too. All we care about is the results, is the answers. We're not going to get in your way on the way there.
We've got about 5 minutes left, John O'Lear, and we're talking about his book, Imagine How Creativity Works. We started with the brain. We've now been talking about companies and teams. You actually end up talking about cities and eras and education. What We've sort of already talked about what an individual can take from this to help them be creative, but what can we do as a society or as a school system and those sorts of things?
The last chapter of the book is, you know, I kind of use Shakespeare as a case study. And I'm particularly interested in what sociologists refer to as ages of excess genius, which are these sudden flourishings of talent. Think ancient Athens, think Renaissance Florence, think Elizabethan England, where you don't just get William Shakespeare. He's living in the same city at the same time with John Donne and Francis Bacon and Christopher Marlowe. And you go down the list, and it is just one genius after another, people who basically invented English literature, and yet they all live in the same zip code, essentially. It's quite befuddling.
Yeah.
And so I was interested in, well, how does that happen? What allows that to happen? I think there are trends and recurring patterns you see in all these ages of excess genius. So you see an expansion of education. So William Shakespeare's father was a glover, signed his name with a mark. He's probably illiterate. And yet William Shakespeare was given a lesson in Latin starting at the age of 8. Simply because there was educational reform, especially in Stratford. So his teacher was a former student at Oxford. Christopher Marlowe got a full scholarship to Cambridge. So you see the pool of human capital expand, where all of a sudden you're able to cultivate talent among people who before would have become a glover, maybe never would have learned to read, and now they can write Hamlet. So that's one theme. You also see new ways of sharing information. So the publishing industry was born. So Shakespeare got access to all these stories and plots, which playwrights before didn't have. So that allowed him to transform, you know, this mediocre melodrama called Hamlet into the Hamlet we know and love. So, you know, you see stuff like that. The comparison I'm most interested in, and this is the point made by Bill James, the pioneer of sabermetrics in baseball. He points out, you look at 21st century America, we are actually very good at cultivating one particular type of genius. And we actually live in an age of excess genius. It's just the geniuses we're very good at cultivating are athletic genius.
And Bill James, for folks, is the guy that's behind the thinking behind Moneyball.
Exactly. And so this is, you know, it's a very interesting point, because he points out, you know, our basketball players, we export them to Europe. They have to have rules against having too many American baseball players on your team in Japan. We win the Olympics every 4 years. So we are very, very good at cultivating athletic talent. And he points out that's because we've got this pipeline for cultivating talent from a very young age. So we drive our kids to Little League and Pop Warner football. We encourage them, if they're talented, they play against other talented kids. Then they can play in the AYSO, and then they get full scholarships at the high school level and the college level. We've trained professional sports teams to make very risky bets on potential talent. So players
Put $10 million into someone that's a project.
Exactly.
And if you're 7 foot, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't.
Exactly. So that filters down. So then you encourage more kids to get in the game.
Now, is the hothouse atmosphere in high schools these days, where people are going to all sorts of tutors, and is that the same thing?
Well, you know, I think what we need to do is to take some of these mechanisms that have made us such a successful powerhouse for athletic talent and apply them to engineering genius and writing genius and painting genius. And we need to, you know, put more money in the game. So we need to encourage kids to say, look, if you're really good at this, it will pay off. You will be able to make a living as a literary novelist.
And as you say, take bets on people more than we do.
Yes, and be willing to invest in potential. Now, that some of those bets won't work out. Some of those draft picks in pro sports, they're busts. But that's the price you pay for encouraging that pipeline.
And one of the things that seems to be true in what you just said and what you said about the era of Shakespeare is when we open up the game to more people, Peter Diamandis in his book Abundance talks about the rising billions who are going to join the internet next year. Stuart Brand says that the areas of most creativity are the slums.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's about expanding the pool of potential human talent. It's about taking those William Shakespeares now who don't have access to a good education and teaching them Greek, teaching them Latin, giving them access to stories they can turn into classic works of literature. It's about, you know, giving people access to these tools, exposing them to passions, things they may fall in love with. So it absolutely is about expanding the playing field.
Okay. If I give you 1 minute, what's the most exciting thing you've learned in terms of your own life out of all this?
For me, it's really the link between our social network and our creativity. So this is, you know, what inspired me is a study done by Martin Reff, a sociologist at Princeton, who he was tracking 766 graduates of Stanford Business School, looking at who went on to become entrepreneurs and trying to figure out how their social network was related to their levels of innovation. He looked at, you know, number of patents, number of trademarks, how much money they made from those patents, stuff like that. What he found is that entrepreneurs with a more diverse social network. So people who didn't just spend time with people who were just like them, but instead sought out all sorts of connections, that they were 3 times more innovative than those who had more predictable social networks. So this has really inspired me to, when you're sitting on a plane, strike up a conversation with the guy sitting next to you. When you're, you know, at a conference, make small talk with all sorts of different people. So don't shy away from those incidental conversations, because it turns out they add up. That is often where our best ideas come from. Steve Jobs has a great line. He said, creativity is just connecting things. Well, most of those connections come from other people.
Very good. That's the voice of Jonah Lehrer. The book is Imagine How Creativity Works. His website is Jonah Lehrer, JonahLehrer.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can also have it signed up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do that at my website and at iTunes. My website is terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, where I tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and probably 2 or 3 articles, sign up at my site or email me at TEMCNALLY@MAC.com. TEMCNALLY@MAC.com. And finally, thank you to Jonah Lehrer. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.